Welcome to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. I'm Stephen Spitz. On today's show, can anything be done to improve our last place scores on education tests? The New Mexico Center for Law and Poverty says yes, and has just completed a 9-week trial offering exactly that proof. We'll talk about all this and the state's defense to that proof with the executive director of the Center for Law and Poverty, Edward Tabat Kubero. Edward Tabat Kubero, welcome to the program.
Great. Thank you so much.
Well, it's great to have you here. And I'd like to spend most of the show on the evidence that was produced in the trial, including the state's evidence. But let's start with why this case. What's this case all about?
Sure. So the case is about New Mexico families and a handful of school districts suing the state for failing to provide public schools with the supports necessary for children to succeed. And you mentioned in the opening, the horrible outcomes that we see, with New Mexico ranking last, kind of showing up at the bottom of all of these reports we see, including last in opportunity for success. And
that's an incredible thing right there. Last in opportunity for success.
Yeah, it's a composite measure that basically looks at poverty rates, school outcomes, parent employment rates, all of these things.
I see.
Put this composite of opportunity for success.
So it's a realistic look at opportunity.
Exactly. And the, unfortunate reality is we rank dead last in that. So our center thinks that our students here in New Mexico are just as capable and have just as much potential as any students across the country. And so they dug into the state constitution, our attorneys at our center, after, consulting with families and school districts, and found this constitutional provision that says the state of New Mexico is responsible for providing a uniform system of free public schools sufficient for the education of all children of school age. And the key words there really are sufficient and uniform.
So sufficient is the thing that the center really focuses on because they argue that how could the school system be sufficient when two-thirds of 4th, 8th, and 11th graders can't read up to at proficiency. Three-fourths of those same students can't do math. So their argument, I guess, is how could that possibly be a sufficient education?
Exactly. That's exactly what we're saying. And, important within that is the onus of responsibility is on the state itself. And so I think that you've seen those outcomes highly politicized, especially in recent time, where blame will be placed on everybody else. Blame will be placed on teachers or teachers' unions. Blame will be placed on school districts, and we're seeing a lot of blame on EPS.
Could I ask you just about that? Because yeah. I saw that in the state's papers. They say, well, we're the public education department. It's up to the school districts to decide what to program and how to program. Is that not true?
Yeah, it's actually first and foremost up to the state public education department, up to the state legislature and the executive branch to provide, the funding necessary. So if school districts are working in a situation where they're totally starved of resources, then how can you fault them? So it begins and ends with the state. I think also the public education department has a key role in providing oversight, monitoring, and then technical assistance and support. So rather than taking this adversarial approach, which we've seen them taking with school districts, why not take an approach of support where they own responsibility for the outcomes for our students and they actually want to be supportive of our teachers, our families, and our school districts?
So let me ask you about the state's defense, which I gleaned from some of the papers they filed, and that is to the effect of when sufficient was put in, sufficient for the education of students, the drafters of that term didn't mean certain outcomes, certain results. They meant the opportunity to learn. And then when you look at the opportunity to learn, we have, you would know this much more than I would, but maybe the highest number of percentage of minority students in the country. We also have the highest poverty rate in the country. Both those factors would suggest, if you just look throughout the United States, low education outcomes. So the state would say, look, we're providing what we can provide. We're actually moving up rankings according to Education Week, we're doing okay. We are providing a sufficient education.
Right. And yeah, I think that they're underestimating the crafters of our state constitution, who included things such as Spanish-speaking pupils. In the state constitution, it says Spanish-speaking pupils in our public schools will forever enjoy perfect equality with their English-speaking peers.
No kidding.
And they talked about how these students, this is back in 1911, 1912, these students will never be housed in separate classrooms, separate schools. And they understood full well what they meant when they said sufficient. They understood full well what they meant when they said perfect equality. And when you look at outcomes for English language learners, Native American and Hispanic students, you see these glaring achievement gaps. I mean, for our English language learners alone in our state, 36% of our families speak a language other than English, which we see as a resource, actually. That's an asset.
That could be a second language or a first language?
Well, they speak a language other than English at home. So it could
be
an indigenous language. It could be Spanish. It could be Vietnamese.
I see.
There's a 40-point gap in their reading achievement with their English-speaking peers.
So that's a shocking number.
Yeah, we see that as grossly insufficient. I mean, the business community gets this. They see this as, economic viability for our state, that we've got to close those gaps. And I think, back to your original point, the drafters of our state constitution knew full well that they were looking for equality across ethnic groups, across language groups, and so on. And when you look at the outcomes, we see these glaring gaps that need to be remedied.
So I feel compelled to point out to listeners, because you're doing such an excellent job, that you're actually not a lawyer. You're responding. Your background is in education, correct?
Yeah, and yeah, I've been in and out of the public schools for the past 20 years. I've done everything from educational assistant to classroom teacher to school principal. I teach here at UNM in the College of Education as well. And then I've provided lots of training for teachers and administrators all across the country. So I've had a chance to do some writing on that, and also just to see what's happening across the country, programs that work, that are effective, and so on. And so I've been able to take, I think, that experience here in New Mexico and nationally, and provide some analysis on this case.
So the basic argument, I guess, at the center is demography isn't really destiny, and poverty isn't really destiny. And there are programs, as you were just suggesting, that work. And I just wonder about this. Was the state in kind of a trick bag of sorts? Because these are the programs, it seems to me, that you're pointing to are the very programs that they say do work.
Exactly. And I think that, part of the issue is we've been able to highlight programs that the state has implemented themselves, but they haven't been able to take them to scale. And so that word uniformity in our state constitution then comes into play, because what happens is if you offer particular programs that we know work for our demographics, for, our low-income students, our minority students, and so on, but you only offer them to some students and then not to others, you're actually perpetuating inequitable outcomes, right? You're only given a dose of a particular remedy to one group, and then you have...
That almost sounds like an equal protection argument.
Yeah, I think that equal protection arguments could definitely be made here. The Office for Civil Rights, based out of the Denver office, has actually taken an interest in what's happening with English language learners here in New Mexico. Our attorneys chose to frame everything in terms of our state constitution, because we think there's plenty of protections.
And when you're trying the case in a state court, that's not a bad thing to do, I think.
Yeah, exactly. But I think it is important to note some of the state's defenses. You were getting to earlier that, their obligation is to provide this minimal framework. But what they said in open court proceedings, the state's attorneys actually said, how can you expect New Mexico to compete when we are a minority majority, student population? We have so many Hispanic and Native American students in our state. He said those students are actually less receptive to education than their peers in other places across the country.
So that sounds like a racist argument.
In my mind, it's as racist as it gets. It's pretty atrocious to think that the state's attorneys made those arguments.
Wow.
And what we're saying is, no, we're not going to blame the children. We're actually going to say the state needs to step up, take responsibility, and provide the programs that 40, 50 years of research show actually work for these children.
So we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, I'd like to just talk to you about at least some of the programs that that you're suggesting the state should expand or propound.
Every orchestra is part of a community, of course. So how does an orchestra respond when a natural disaster affects everyone and everything? I'm Fred Child. Join me for updates from the Houston Symphony in the wake of Hurricane Harvey on the next Performance Today from APM.
Weekday mornings at 9 on KUNM.
We are back on New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. My name is Stephen Spitz, and I'm very pleased to have in the studio Edward Tabat Cubero. Edward is the executive director, and he's a lay executive director. He's not a lawyer, of the Center for Law and Poverty. And the Center for Law and Poverty has just completed a 9-week trial. And one of the things that occurred at the trial was the center put forth various programs that they thought would help education dramatically, and one of them is something I'm sure everybody's heard of, which is pre-K. Could you talk a little bit about the center's position on pre-K? I mean, there is pre-K in New Mexico, right?
Yeah, there is pre-K, and interestingly, you know, we have a myriad of early childhood programs, from home visitation through early pre-K, pre-K, and so on. And we also have another program called K3 Plus,
right,
which has been implemented for several years now, which offers 25 extra school days during the summer for children who may be struggling a little bit.
And is there after school hours extended too, or is that just a summer program?
That's okay. Just a summer program, but okay, we also would push on the after school hours. But
I see.
Interestingly enough, about a week and a half ago, the Legislative Finance Committee came out with this report that showed the combination of pre-K programming and K3 plus programming actually closes the achievement gap for students who have historically been underserved. So there's two programs that couple together we know work. The problem is there are 19,000 four-year-olds in our state right now who need pre-K or a Head Start type program, and they don't have access to those because of insufficient funding.
So there's what, about 5,000 kids who are getting it and 19,000 that aren't, or something like that?
Yeah, there's more. I mean, we've increased funding over time. I don't have the exact numbers today on how many, but we know there are 19,000 that are not participating.
So we know in general there's like 28,000 births a year, right?
Right.
So 82% of those are Medicaid qualified.
Exactly.
So the 19,000 number is not a very surprising number when you think about it in those terms. If those kids aren't getting it, they're not getting the opportunity that you're talking about, right?
Exactly. And it's the situation, is even more expansive if you look at grades, you know, pre-K through third grade, where we have this K3 plus program, but there's 70,000 students who need that program that we know works, and they don't have access to it.
So, and where does that number come from? Is that, where does the 70,000 number come from?
That's the number of students who would be eligible for the program between incoming kindergartners through incoming third graders this past summer.
And what makes you eligible? What makes a child eligible for that program?
Yeah, there's a variety of factors. Their current achievement rates, they're behind in reading or math.
I see.
They may attend a lower performing school. There's, you know, possibly some economic factors, but it's normally just their achievement rates and the fact that they're attending a lower performing school. And I know I ran the pre-K programs and the K3 plus programs when I was an assistant superintendent of schools in Santa Fe. And here was the reality that was heartbreaking, is that only certain, you know, there's a very limited amount of funding for these programs. So only certain schools got the program, and you would have, you know, dozens and dozens, over 100 calls for our pre-K programs with parents calling and saying, hey, I really want my child in this program. How do I register them? Or I want them in K3 plus. How do I register them? And we'd have to, unfortunately, explain to them that because of the school your child's in and a lack of funding, they don't have access to that programming. So you have motivated parents that want the programming that can't get in.
So a lot, I mean, that's, if you just use a round number, like 20,000 kids need pre-K and it costs $5,000 a year, something like that, for pre-K, that's $100 million. That's a lot of money.
So we don't fund pre-K at the same level that we fund the K-12 system.
Uh-huh.
So it's actually about $23 million is what the LFC estimated last week.
To fully fund the 19,000 kids that don't get it right now.
Right, the 19,000 4-year-olds.
And is that full-day pre-K or half-day pre-K that they're talking
about? I think they're basing that on kind of current enrollment, a mix of the half-day and the full-day programs.
I see, yeah, because those numbers to me don't add up.
Yeah, full-day would be much more expensive. And
right.
That's part of the issue, too, you see across the state is you have these different – there's two totally different revenue streams from the state legislature, one for the full-day programs, one for the half-day programs. And you don't see as much utilization of the half-day as you do for the full-day, and then you end up with these waiting lists for full-day.
So what about 3-year-olds? There are starter programs for 3-year-olds for pre-K, but it's very limited, as I understand it.
Yeah, it's extremely limited. The majority of the students in our
kids.
State, exactly, don't have access to that.
So one other sort of question along this line, which is home visiting. And, you know, based on what I've read about early childhood programs, the earlier the better. It seems to me that one of the things that people always focus on are the cognitive results from these programs, whereas the non-cognitive results are just as important, if not more important. You know, can the child sit still? Can the child stop talking? Can the child sit and learn? Does the child able to do her homework? You know, these are things that are incredibly important and that are developed by not just pre-K, but home visiting programs too. But the state in general says, hey, this isn't our problem. You know, home visiting, that's not education. Pre-K, that child's not 5 years old. What's the center's answer to those contentions?
Yeah, I think that's a great question around home visitation. That's a little bit separate from the litigation we're talking about. But one of the things that our center did, because we know the positive impact that home visitation has, is we were able to promote the development of a pilot program with the legislature this year, where you can actually get the state to apply for federal Medicaid reimbursement to support home visitation. And basically,
right,
in
the
that
state's
program,
been, for some reason that I never could understand, the state would not take advantage of these federal funds to fund home visiting programs, Medicaid funds.
Exactly. And we get reimbursed 70 cents on the dollar for home visitation with Medicaid.
So that started, that has started now.
Yeah, there's a pilot program that's
a
going
pilot
to be started.
Program.
You know, started up. But for us, it really makes no sense to leave money on the table with the feds if they're willing to, offer 70 cents on the dollar for, a home visitation program that we know has very positive impacts for entire families, not just the children, but on the parents as well.
So I want to talk to you about one other program I know that you guys advocated for, and this is something I think that you know a heck of a lot about, and that's dual language instruction.
Mm-hmm.
As you said earlier, there's a high percentage of families where English really isn't spoken at home. And those kids go to school and they're not familiar with English. And the results of those kids, as you said, I mean, their proficiency results are in the single digits.
Yeah.
So the state doesn't really disagree that dual language instruction is good, right?
Right. In fact, we actually, in New Mexico, incentivize bilingual education, and particularly the dual language model. There's five different, you know, models of bilingual education that are incentivized in our state funding formula.
No kidding.
And dual language actually generates more funding than any other type of program because we have 40 years of research that shows that it works. Kids actually, it's the only program where kids who are learning English as a second language fully close the achievement gap. That's one. Two, they're able to learn English and maintain their native language And three, those programs are offered to all students. So English-speaking families who want their child to learn another language actually have access to those programs. So it's a win-win for everybody.
Yeah, I have some Mexican-American friends who really don't speak Spanish. They want their kids to speak Spanish.
Right.
Though, right.
Yeah, so. Exactly. And I think that even just from an economic perspective, I think the business leaders in our community that I talk with say that our bilingualism is truly an asset that we have here in the state of New Mexico.
So what happened to the old idea of English immersion? You just take a kid who hasn't spoken English at home, you stick that kid in a class, and they learn English, and they progress. That's right. Been shown, I take it, not to be the case for a lot of kids.
Shows to be the least effective model.
The least effective.
We know it takes 5 to 7 years to gain academic proficiency in a second language, and so the question I would have for folks that would perpetuate that model is, while they're learning English, how are they learning math? How are they learning science? How are they learning social studies? How are they learning critical thinking skills? You know, they have to be offered something in a language they understand while they learn English. And as a bilingual, a dual language educator, I have to say, yes, our students absolutely must learn English. The question is, do they have to give up this precious asset that they have in another language along the way? And can they be taught these other subjects in a language they understand while they're learning English?
Well, if you've just tuned in, this is New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. My name is Stephen Spitz, and I'm very pleased to have in the studio Edward Tabert Cabero. And I just have a couple more questions on the dual language issue. One of the things I noticed the state says is, you know, we've got all these different pueblos. They speak different languages. You know, it's really, you're asking too much of us to try to get English language, dual language teachers into all these schools.
Yeah, I think that there's a fundamental right, in especially in the case of our tribal communities. If they lose their language, they lose their entire way of life. They can't self-govern at that point. And we're talking about sovereign, you know, nations here who rely on their language for self-governance. They're also, their religious practices, you know, can't be implemented without the language. So it's even more vital. It's beyond kind of economic viability. It comes down to an entire people's way of life, you know, by maintaining their language. And we have tribes that are doing things that they've really got it right. So you're seeing across the state, you know, certain communities actually taking over their school from the Bureau of Indian Education and implementing their own tribal language revitalization programs in these schools. The other thing we've done is been able to develop partnerships between tribal communities and the public schools so that they could bring in their own language instructors. And it's simply a matter of setting up that structure in the public school, Bernalillo Public Schools, for example, that has 5 pueblos that feed into it, working in consultation and in response to the needs of the tribal communities to bring in experts in these languages and then offer them, you know, to the children that come from each of those respective
tribes.
So it's
the whole argument in this area. It seems like the whole argument in the whole area is really funding, because the state seems to believe in, I mean, the state believes in K-3+, state believes in pre-K, state believes in dual language instruction. It's just all underfunded, and therefore the programs aren't being extended to the people who need them, the kids who need them.
Yeah, I think funding is one question, but I think it's also a matter of the political will, the political courage to do this. You see Utah, who, you know, a Republican governor set out a goal of, we're going to expand 100 dual language programs across our state in 4 years.
100?
And so they, you know, and they built up the infrastructure to actually do that. In New Mexico, out of the 900 and some odd public schools we have, only 117 are offering dual language programs right now. So we need an expansion of those types of programs.
You got about 800 schools that don't have it.
Exactly. 60% of the English language learners in our state don't have access to these types of programs that we know work. Like the jury's not out anymore. It's in, and we know the programs work. And funding does come into play. You know, we think that the system overall is grossly underfunded. The state has starved our schools for too long. It's to the point where we are still, when you factor in inflation, below pre-recession funding levels.
So this really gets me to what I think is maybe the hardest aspect of the case, and that is the remedy. Mm-hmm. Because in the end, what you have to do is get the court to order these programs to, you know, be promulgated and to fund them. And that, in essence, is the court taking over the school system. The court is now going to say, these are the programs that have to be funded. I know regularly the legislature does it and the governor does it, but, you know, now the court's going to say you have to do it. And that, I mean, that is really putting the court in the middle of a political question that's a very difficult question. And, by the way, where's the money going to come from? Because it's not there. So, what's your feeling about the remedy?
Yeah, let's take the two parts of that question separately. So the first part on the role of the courts, we have three equal branches of government. When there is a question of constitutional rights, it's the court's job to chime in on that. And so all we're calling into question in this lawsuit is whether or not what's being provided is violating the constitutional rights of students in our state. And we think that the evidence clearly shows there's a violation of their constitutional rights to a sufficient and uniform system of public schooling.
So that's liability. But then, you know, how does it, you're asking the court to do a very somewhat unusual thing. I mean, other states have also had these litigations, and other states have had orders like the orders you seek, but it's still a very difficult question to get the court to order it, correct? I mean, the court's going to have to. Where's the money going to come from, Edward? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so first, I guess, on the court's role, declare the system unconstitutional, put the onus of responsibility back on the state to bring the system into compliance with the Constitution, the sufficiency clause there. So that's kind of the first part. And of course, we have some ideas about the programs that we're talking about that work. The second thing is those programs do cost money. And, you know, we have had several folks do analysis in our state. The legislators themselves hired the American Institutes of Research several years ago to do a study. And their own study came out to show that our entire system was grossly underfunded.
Like $300 million,
right? At that time, yeah. And in today's dollars, it would be, you know, more.
So, I heard $500 million in today's dollars. So $500 million, half a billion dollars isn't sitting there. I mean, every state agency that I know, CYFD, Medicaid, they're all starved for money. So where is this? If the court were to do this and say, hey, you've got to fund the schools to another $500 million, mm-hmm. where is this money going to come from? Are we just going to eliminate other agencies?
Yeah, so the key question is to look back at all of the revenues that the state has given away over time. So we have, 2013 corporate income tax reductions that right now equate to about $70 million away a year of tax giveaways to corporations. And if you just froze them at the current levels, because they're going to continue to be increased through 2018, you'd save at least $15 million between this year and next year. There was a huge personal income tax reduction for New Mexico's highest earners that total in 2003 that totals over $300 million a year. So those two tax giveaways right there, corporate gains deduction, and then I think at looking at that, Swiss cheese of exemptions in our tax code, we'd easily find $800 million that would more than, pay for any kind of education remedies we might be looking
for. Edward, I'm sorry to say we're out of time. I'd like to thank my guests so much today, Edward Tabat Cubero, the Executive Director of the New Mexico Center for Law and Poverty. Thanks also to my engineer today, Roman Garcia. My executive producer is Lynn Shebeki. My name is Stephen Spitz, and you've been listening to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas on KUNM. Podcasts of this show are available at iTunes. Search Stephen Spitz. Archives of my past shows are at stephenspitz.com. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.